Welcome to Halacha in a Year, where we can get to learn all the most relevant halacha through the prism of the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. You are listening to Rabbi Yaakov Tramp. This shiur is kindly sponsored by the Moshe Group and CA in Zuchus of Rivka Bela Bas Nechama Shifra and in honor of Rabbi Tramp. Today we're going to be looking at the halachas of business. This is Simon Samach Beis, the 62nd chapter in the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch. What the Ketzer does here again is one of the superpowers that he has is he takes all the ideas which come from all different areas in the Shulchan Aruch, and he puts them together into bite-sized ideas that we can amalgamate, we can approach and appreciate in our own lives. So this over here, what he does is he takes a few very common halachas and he puts them all together. The halachas that we're going to look to get at today are oinah, which is the law of deceit. Then we also talk about deceitful marketing, honest measures, keeping one's commitments, and precedence in selling of land. Those are the five concepts for today. Let's jump straight in with the Isser of Oinah. The Torah tells us the following. The Torah tells us that when you sell or when you buy, you're not allowed to deceive or defraud another person as well. And this is the first, the Shkitzer points out that this is the first question that a person is asked when they come to Shemaim, and that is the Nosasa v'nosata be'emuna, did you trade, did you conduct yourself in the marketplace in an honest and upright fashion? So just to understand the parameters of this, as over here, a few basic questions. What's involved in this Isser? The Isser is when one deceives one's friend when selling them a product, or deceives them when buying a product as well. Wait a second. How could it be there's deception from the buyer's perspective? So that exists where a person doesn't know the value of the item they're selling, and you convince them to sell it for under its value, then that would be considered a deceit that would be considered oinah. Is this just in selling? So the Kisra says no, it applies to renting, contracting, and also money changing. A person cannot deceive and therefore defraud their friend with exorbitant amounts. What if you tell the other person what you got it for and what you're selling it for? So let's say the following. Just a question before that is, let's say I was defrauded. Somebody sold it to me for well above its regular market price. Am I allowed to just pass that through and then defraud the next person? The answer is no. But if I tell somebody, look, I got this at a very high price, so I'm going to have to mark it up slightly, you know, whatever, 1%, and I'm selling it to you for that. If the person agrees in that case, then it should be all right as well. There's a lot of halachas that relate to this. We're not going to get into all of them now, but just to be aware of this, is that oinah is generally considered to 1/6 of the price, is within that range is considered a claim for oinah. If it's about that's the range of oinah, and if it's more than that, it's considered a mekach tos, it is a faulty sale, and the sale can be retroactively reneged. It's complicated because there are times that oinah or price hikes are allowed. So for instance, the Gemara talks about on Erev Shabbos when there's high demand. And in generally, if let's say you're in a place where the market will bear, where generally speaking, the demand is high, around particular products or just because of the area, then in those circumstances, it might be less clear that there is oinah as well. In general, it's about honest marketing. And there are a lot of halachas and lots and lots of halachas that apply from this. The idea is being honest about the way one buys and the way one sells and not taking people for a ride, whether it's the seller or the buyer. The next halacha that we're going to look at is deceitful marketing. So a few basic questions. Marketing is usually a very big part of selling. Are there limits to marketing? The answer is yes. You're not allowed to market something if it is deceptive. So what are examples? So if you go back to Matilda, Roald Dahl's Matilda, Mr. Wormwood, that's Matilda's father. He sells secondhand cars, you know, and he puts, you know, sawdust in the gearbox and he reverses the odometer. Yeah, you do those kind of things, that's not allowed. In more common places, examples are painting old utensils to sell them as if they're new. You're allowed to obviously touch up things, but not to pretend as if they're brand new. Or giving food, which bloats animals before putting them on market. And we can think of many other situations as well. One would wonder about the types of ads that go on about food these days. You know, a lot of foods on cereal boxes, the milk is not milk, it's glue. And the droplets on these refreshing looking drinks are usually also glue. You know, like so, you know, hamburgers have pictures of the black lines on them are usually from shoe polish. You know, so it will be a concern of are you really selling? Or you're just pretending. What happens if the item I'm selling is partially good and partially bad? So you have to be careful. One cannot add bad fruits to the good ones and get the bad fruits. Certain, and one cannot mix bad drinks with good drinks. But if it is recognizable and therefore not deceptive, then you can sell it. Meaning to say, if it's possible for the person to check it out and see what's inside it or taste it and know what's inside of it, if they taste beforehand, then that would be all right. But you're not allowed to do it in a way that it would be deceiving the person. What about just regular marketing tactics? So, for instance, free giveaways, candy prizes for kids who come to the store, bringing the price below competition. What about that kind of marketing? That's fine, because and nobody else can complain, because these are not deceptive. These are specific marketing techniques that many stores use when they're about to start, when they're getting started. These are things which are of common practice and are totally fine. It is the deception which is a problem as well. We move to our third concept, and that is honest measures. The Torah says, it tells us very explicitly, that you're not allowed mesura. You're not allowed to do deceit or defraud people when it comes to the measures. In the old ways, it used to be, is it wasn't that you get like these packaged items in the supermarket. You go to the grocery and you ask for a few pounds of flour, and they would go and they had stones and they would weigh against the flour, and that would be how they did it. Or they would put it into a cup and smooth off the cup, and there were conventions as how to give it. And so the way people would cheat would be, they would like dent the cup so there would be less volume in the cup, or they would make a measure which says it's a 1 pound measure of weight, but really it was slightly less. So therefore you're getting less as well. So all these kinds of things that the Torah strictly prohibits these as well. Cooking the books, doing things like that would lead to this as well. And the Torah even goes so far as to say, you're not allowed even own incorrect measures as well. And the Torah tells us very, very specific details about this. This is in the Parshas Kiseitzeh. Does this apply to only Jews? The answer is no. This applies to all human beings. Sometimes you hear Jews who don't think that it matters when one cheats people, regular human beings outside the Jewish people. That's not what the Torah says. It's all prohibited. Should I be exacting? So the answer is no. It's always better to actually be the other way, to be a little more. The Torah says, based on the Medrash, which has said, Eifosh Shlema Vetzedek Yelacha, you should have good measures. What does it mean, righteous? Amra Torah, tzedek mishalcha, v'tenai. Give a little extra. Be a little bit more. Be the nice guy. You need to go the extra mile, not the opposite way around. What if I want to measure the way my customer wants it, so that my customer is willing to waive the local convention? So, for instance, if the local convention is that when you measure, let's say, a dry product, you heap it up on the cup and then give it, rather than smoothing it out. And that's the convention in my locale. But my customer says it's fine, you can scrape it over, and that means he's getting less. You're not allowed to do that. You have to stick with the local convention. And generally speaking, it's going to come back to bite you if you don't do this properly. What is the community's responsibility regarding to this? So, in generally, the community must enforce honest measures and have its own warning and penalty system to avoid members of the community acting deceitfully. This obviously presupposes that the community has any standing or leverage to direct its community members to do so. In the general Western model, where any form of leverage on the communal model is seen as patriarchal, it's much harder to leverage this. But in the old days, when communities were governed by rabbinic bodies or just social bodies in towns, then the responsibility was upon them to make sure that there was warnings and penalties in order to avoid the community members behaving in an untoward fashion. What if I have an imperfect measure, a weight or a measuring cup, but I just don't use it? I just keep it in, you know, the closet. I don't use it. So in that case, you're not allowed to. The Torah says you're not allowed to even own such a thing. What happens if I use it as a bedpan? So who's going to use that? It's still usur, because you never know the situation. You may just have to clean it out and use it, and then you'll be doing it deceitfully. What happens if I may, if to measure something, I need to have an official stamp on the container, and this one does not have the official stamp from, the, let's say, government regulation authorities? In that case, you're allowed to keep it, because no one would accept a measuring tool which is not stamped as well. We move to our fourth concept. What about keeping one's commitment? So, if a sale agreement was reached between two parties, can a third party offer a better bid? Can they tender a better bid after the agreement was reached? The answer is, if a person does so, they are called a rasha. What happens if the one side was accepting of the deal and the other side had not yet accepted it? Can a third party put in the bid? The answer is yes, because they have not arrived at an agreement yet. What if a person sends an agent to buy something, but the agent uses his own money and buys it for himself, sees it's a good deal, drops his agency and buys it for himself? In that case, that person is considered a ramai, a cheat, so you're not allowed to do that. What happens if the person who's the agent now uses the money of the person who sent him in the first place? In that case, it belongs to the sender, even though he may have thought it belongs to him. It actually belongs to the sender, because he used his money. What happens if a person pays a down payment on an item, or they were so interested in buying it, they asked them to mark it, that they're kind of, it's going to be for them, and then they decide to back out. Is it all right? The answer is no. Such a person receives what's called a mishapara. Mishapara is a curse, and it reads as follows. Mishapara me'antra dara mabul, u'me'antra dara palaga, u'me'antra sadaim, he got a god who paid back the people of the generation of the flood, the people of the generation of dispersion, the people of Sodom and Amorah, and the people in Mitzrayim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu drowned them. Then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will pay for a person who doesn't stand by their word. So that going back in such a situation is seen as a very terrible thing. What if no down payment was made, no object was marked, but it was agreed upon verbally, and I did not, and I want to go back? So in this case, you should absolutely keep your side. If you don't, you're considered a mechusar amona, a person who's lacking faith. And he says, Roy lekol Yisrael amor b'diburoi. Every person should be stand by their word, as the pasuk says, Sheri Sashola yasu avlo yad burchazov. The remainder of Israel will not do falsehood and not speak falsely. What if I agreed to a price in my head, but the other side then offers more, not realizing that I'd already been good with their deal? So they offered 10. I think, 10's great. And before I can say that's great, they say, no, 15. So in that case, the Gemara says, quoting one of the great Amoraim in the Gemara, who says that a Yirei Shamai, a person who fears heavens, should go back to what they agreed upon in their head and not take the person for the ride for more as well in this situation. What happens if I made a commitment in my heart to do something? Do I need to keep it? So, it depends. So it says, you should do what you thought about in your heart. If you want to do something good, you should do it. But when it comes to tzorchi atzmo, kol she'en b'im srach mitzvah, ein tzorech l'kam afilu moitzah sosav. It was something about for yourself, and it wasn't related to a mitzvah, then you do not need to come and follow through with that. It was for another person, or it was for a mitzvah, then you must. What if I said I would give a friend a gift? Is that binding? So if it's a small gift, then yes. But a big gift, technically no, because many people don't think that you're going to follow through if it's such a big gift. But it's still, when a person says they're going to give and they do it with a das shlema, with full knowledge, you should make sure that your word is kept. That hin tzedek, your yes should be yes, your no should be no. If you say something, you should really do it. What about staka? So a person says they're going to give money to the poor, then whether it's a lot, whether it's a little, a person is not allowed to halachically retract from that. If a person makes a commitment, a pledge, they're not allowed to as well. This is it's considered that speech itself is binding when it comes to this. People should check their staka accounts. They should check what they committed to community appeals. It's a very serious issue. Finally, last issue that we can deal with is the concept of precedence when it comes to selling of land. The Torah tells us that based on the pasuk Ba'asisa Yashav Atov in Devarim, that you should do what is right and good in the eyes of God. That there's what's called dinah debar metzra. What is this halacha? And the halacha is that if a person's selling the property, precedence goes to certain people. So let's go through this quickly. If there's a decision, if I'm selling my property, who gets the first rights to buying? The neighbor or the non-neighbor? The neighbor always gets precedence because it's more helpful to the neighbor than the non-neighbor. What happens if I'm selling to a local or for a person from another city? The local gets first dibs. What happens if it's the difference between a friend and a relative? A friend gets first because Toiv Shachin, Karov, Mi, Ach, Rachok, it's better to have a good neighbor than a distant relation. What happens if I'm selling it and it's between a buyer off the street and a relative? The relative gets before the buyer off the street. What happens if it's between a Talmud Chacham and a relative? The Talmud Chacham goes first. What about a neighbor and a Talmud Chacham? The neighbor gets first. That's dinah debar metzra, because a neighbor can use those properties adjacent to each other more than anybody else as well. What if the land was already sold? So the relative can eject the person, or the neighbor can eject the person who had bought it, because they really do have the rights to that, halachically speaking, as Vasisa Yashavatov. This is an example, the Ramban says, in Sefer Devarim, of the Torah regulating a general principle. The Torah says, be good. Here is an example of how Chazal regulated in such a way to tell us exactly what is required. With this, we close. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.